Hi, I'm Tori Maguire, and this is Please Explain. This week, we're doing something a little different. We're going to take you to a pair of live discussion panel events held by the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age to discuss the biggest stories of the year.
This is the right deal for Britain because it delivers on the democratic decision of the British people.
Now, our job, particularly for Josh and I, as we take forward this new mantle of leadership as a new generation.
We're not going to give up hundreds of billions of dollars in orders. Saudi Arabia, if we broke with them, I think your oil prices would go through the roof. I've kept them.
Now, I hope you're okay with jet lag, because we're going around the globe in 20 minutes to revisit the biggest stories affecting our world, including the ongoing attempts to push Brexit through the UK Parliament, China's rising global influence, to Donald Trump's second year as president. Also, just a heads up, the events were held at the end of November, and some of the stories we've discussed have had many updates since. The biggest, perhaps being that UK Prime Minister Theresa May survived a leadership challenge from her own party over the Brexit proposal. Here with Nick O'Malley, senior writer from The Herald, who was also Herald's US correspondent for...
Well, four and a bit years.
Yeah, that's a long time. Peter Harcher, international and political editor.
Again.
And James Chessel, our executive editor, who was until about a year ago the Financial Review's London correspondent for 4 years. London is where we are going to start on this incredibly quick journey around the world. I don't know how we're going to fit all this in, but there's a lot, because there's a lot to discuss. James, the headlines on the British papers tonight as we walked in here are that Theresa May is being hunted by her Conservative colleagues. Are we about to meet Prime Minister Boris Johnson?
It is a distinct and concerning possibility. The magic number for Theresa May and Boris, for that matter, is 48. If 48 Tory MPs write in, that will trigger a no-confidence vote. That's 15% of the party in total. And then if 50%, the majority, then vote against her, she's out. And that would have huge ramifications for the UK at the best of times, but given they're in the middle of the most important post-war negotiations they've ever had, it will be really critical to see how this plays out.
So she had a plan that she came out of her meeting with her MPs with, thinking that they were behind, and then her Brexit secretary promptly resigned.
Yep. Two cabinet ministers, yeah.
So what happens to that plan now? Can so she that, hold it together?
I think she can hold it together, but I think she may not. The plan will go to the EU on November the 25th, and they'll probably say that's okay, and then it'll go back to the UK Parliament. But it's been so far one of the, if not the longest divorce in history, certainly the costliest. And... you know, I was there in 2016 when the vote occurred. I was living in West London with in a street with a lot of French people and a lot of Spanish people, and I've never seen anything like it. The people were literally crying at the school drop-off. London changed that day, and you know, I don't want to overcook it. It did bounce back to a certain extent, but there was a real sense of unhappiness in the city. And remember, London overwhelmingly voted in favour of Remain.
So what happens if her plan does fall apart and she can't hold it together? Do they need to have a new election? Do they need to have a new referendum? Or do they go to a hard Brexit?
Look, if she loses... So just a quick recap of her plan, which is 565 pages long, so I'll keep it very quick. But, you know, she wants a £40 billion settlement. She wants a 20-month transition period. She wants some broad but non-binding agreements about the future. And critically, she wants this backstop agreement involving Ireland, where basically they try and ensure that there's not a hard border between Northern Ireland and Republic of Ireland. And that's the most contentious bit, because it effectively creates a single customs territory between the UK and the EU. And the hard Brexiters, the conservative wing of her party, think that that's not a proper separation if you've still got some kind of customs arrangement. So, to answer your question, if that comes back to them in December and they say it's not good enough and the plan's knocked off, her political reason for being no longer exist, and she will almost certainly have to step down.
Is this, Peter, Brexit, does it have any consequences for us? I mean, there are things that they have that made it look better for us in the way that we might have better trade with the UK because they need better trading partners. We might be able to skip the queue at Heathrow again, which would be nice. But, like, how much impact does that have on us, really?
Well, in our core national interests, not very much. Strategically, Britain hasn't been important since the fall of Singapore to Australia. Economically, Britain hasn't been vital to Australia since UK joined the European Common Market. It's now only our third biggest source of immigrants after India and China. So in those hardcore national interests, it's a fond relation, but not a kind of current heartthrob, if I may say. But it is interesting political theatre. It is a country to whom our politics and politicians look for tricks of the trade. It is also, I would suggest, a case study for us, a moral story, which is, and we see the same in the US, these are countries where economic shock was then translated into an internal politics of intense blame, and that internal direction of blame and hatred produces this entirely counterproductive clash. James, you described it as the longest divorce in history. I would suggest maybe the longest suicide in national history. Little Britain gets smaller. It's demonstrably, clearly, the Brits have their own view. That's their country's future. But it will clearly make Britain a less important and less relevant country in the world, in that it assists Australia to have a country that is like-minded, a democracy that is in favour of all the norms that we are. That's bad for us, in that it's a member of the Five Eyes intelligence system. It's bad for us that Britain get weaker and smaller. But it is not our main game anymore.
Okay, so speaking of blame and hatred, sorry, James.
I just wanted to add, I think it's a really good point, but what has been overlooked in this whole Brexit drama, which has been very captivating, is that it's bad for Europe as well,
yes.
To go to your point.
Yes.
The UK was a good influence on Europe, both in terms of strategic matters and economic matters. And the bottom line is if and when the UK leaves, and I think it will leave, the EU will continue, the European project won't disintegrate. But for some of the factors you just mentioned, Peter, the post-GFC rebuild, which hasn't gone particularly well, a much more mortal threat to Europe is what's going on in Italy at the moment, where they're arguing about how Italy should pay back debt. And a few years ago it was Greece, and Germany was able to bail out Greece. Germany cannot bail out Italy. It is far too big. So if people think Brexit happens and then the EU is just going to sail off into a bright future, they're mistaken. It's a very fractious environment there, and populism and people leaning towards the Kremlin on certain things. It's pretty worrying, to be honest.
Okay, so we're going to scoot straight across the Atlantic and talk about what the midterm election results in the US can tell us about the health of the Trump administration.
They tell us a couple of things. One, that Trump remains an incredibly dominant figure. That the Trump conversion of the Republican Party to a Trump party is intact, and it's almost complete. You still have sort of grand old men of the Senate like Lindsey Graham backing Trump because, he sees that's the way to maintain GOP power in the senior house. But what does that tell us? That means that what was a far broader party and a party that had broader appeal is now almost a party, an ethno-nationalistic party. And so that tells us something about the State of the Union. It tells us something about the Republican Party. The other thing is people keep on asking, was it a blue wave? And I think the answer is yes and no, which is a terrible, boring answer, I know. But if you look in the House, the Democrats managed to take, at last count, I think 37 seats. By anyone's measure, that is a wave. If you look in the Senate, they didn't. But everyone has made the point that they had an impossible map in the Senate. But I take a step back and I say, whatever those huge gains were, and really important gains, which I won't go into, in the States, in gubernatorial races, there was still no repudiation of Trumpism, if not Trump. And I think that, I'm beginning to think that either American politics and political unity as we understand it survives Trump, or Trump does. They can't both. One or the other has to come to an end at some stage.
So he's coming up for 2 years in the White House. Has he achieved anything?
He's achieved his dominance over the Republican Party. If you look at, and I suppose another great achievement of his is to claim an economic recovery, which was already well in train before he took office.
The company tax cuts didn't assist?
I'm sure they've assisted. It's almost like massive tax cuts at a time which is out of cycle from most economists' point of view. They've been a stimulus package at a time when you didn't really need a stimulus package. But, yeah, no one's arguing the economy is strong. But his main policy achievements have almost... They've been the things that he can simply announce. So he can announce, he can pull out of Paris, he can blow up NAFTA, he can arbitrarily move the embassy. These are all things that he can simply announce. They're not the achievements of presidents who are willing to get into the painstaking work of convincing a recalcitrant legislature, of drafting or driving, the drafting of massive pieces of legislation. They're him waving his presidential wand. And he's had a handful of those, and he's been able to say to his most dedicated followers, here I am, here's what I've done. So he has that list.
Peter, what do you think are the greatest dangers in the continuation of the Trump administration? What's the biggest risk we face from him?
Other than Donald Trump himself. Well, look, I just want, first of all, give a very quick response to what Nick has said. They asked Donald Trump the same question today. What do you think, how would you rate your own presidency?
Tremendous.
He asked on a TV interview.
A plus.
And he said, well, I hate to say this about myself, but A plus, can you go any higher? And she said, well, hang on, there's Lincoln and there's Washington and, where would you rate yourself? And he said, yeah, A plus. So there's the short answer. Perfect. Most dangerous? Well, at a time when you have, in the world, you have a dominant power and you have a rising, thrusting power, an ambitious power, it's normal, of course, that one is status quo and the other is a revisionist party that wants to change. What we have, however, is a dominant power and a rising power, which are both revisionist powers, both of which want to disrupt the international order. That is the biggest single danger that Trump's America poses, because he has torn up every existing norm. He's repudiated solemn US undertakings and treaties, not only with his nearest neighbours on trade, but with the Group of Eight on the Iranian nuclear accord, which technically liberates Iran now if they choose to take it, to fully resume their nuclear arms program. But he's attacked allies, breaking agreements, breaking alliances, which serves China's interests very nicely, thank you very much. And yet now Trump is going to try to confront China, and the two of them... It's a bizarre situation where you have two revisionists both trying to destroy the furniture.
He's also demonstrated no interest in the region. He doesn't turn up to any of the international meetings in the region. He sends Pence.
And I had some Americans arguing to me today that this was, in fact, far better for Asia.
Which brings us so neatly across the Pacific and into another area that I really want to talk about, which is our relationship with China. We Maurice Payne made the first senior Australian government visit on Chinese soil in almost 3 years. Are we out of the freezer?
We in Australia have trained ourselves into this bizarre psychology where we have this relationship with China that we wouldn't tolerate for a second with America or New Zealand or Indonesia, and that is we are constantly living in fear and thinking that the Chinese will be right to vent fear on us, and we should live in fear and we should always be ready to kowtow and to make concessions. It's really bizarre, but good on the Chinese. It's great statesmanship if you can craft an outcome that way. In fact, Australia being put in the freezer has had has really only had one material effect, and that is ministerial exchange has been affected, ministerial visits between the two countries for a year. Well, so what? The wine industry, which was supposed to be one of the suffering points of economic punishment, where the Chinese were punishing Australian exports, has in fact had a boom year, tremendous surge in sales and profits to China. It was largely, the point I'm making is it was largely Chinese theatre, not underlying substance. Yet the Chinese have now have still managed to manage the psychology of this relationship very well, so that now China is under tremendous pressure. There are sources of an indigenous economic slowdown because China was overheating with too much stimulus, too much risk to financial stability in the private sector. The Chinese have been trying to tamp that down. At the same time, the Americans, courtesy of Trump, hit them with these punitive tariffs and investment restrictions. That's causing more shock to the Chinese economy. Under the pressure of this, the Chinese have now decided they need more friends. They've now suddenly discovered the value of friendship with Japan, the country that the Chinese loathe more than any on the planet. They're now having a reconciliation with Japan. They're having a reconciliation with everybody. They're having a reconciliation with us. Now, the Chinese have trained us so well. Look at our public debate about this. We go, oh, phew, thank God, the Chinese are letting us off the hook. It's a good relationship if you can get it, and that's clever work by them. But the point is that we trade with each other for mutual convenience. They're not doing us a favour by buying our products, by investing in our land.
James, how worried has the Australian business community been about the fact that we did appear to be in the freezer? I mean, not much has actually changed in the issues that we have in our relationship with China, other than the rhetoric in the last 2 weeks.
Well, I think it reflects a bit what Peter was described then. If you ask people in the business community or the education sector, which is absolutely depends on, in the tertiary education, depends on our relationship with China, they will say to you, oh, I'm very worried, very concerned. This is a real worry. We want the government to tone down its rhetoric. We want you to stop writing about China influence. We'd like you to be a lot more positive about the relationship. And then you say, so how is business with China? They go, oh, terrific, absolutely fine.
But this is the thing.
There's a gap between reality and perception, I think.
It's also this fear of the immediate future, especially when you write about influence in universities. There's always this knowledge that 40% of income is now coming from Chinese students. What if they use it for leverage? No, there's no evidence that it has been done, but there's been signals about it.
Of course, the Chinese may one day attempt that. I'd say two things. Peter Varghese, who used to be the head of the Department of Foreign Affairs, is now the Chancellor of Queensland, gave the most practical speech I've seen about how Australia should deal with pressure from China a few weeks ago. He said to a vice-chancellor's conference, he said, we, meaning the university, should be taking the profit we earn each year on our Chinese students and not using it to pay recurrent bills. We should be putting it in a scholarship fund or a future fund against the day when, through no fault of our own, he said, the student numbers should fall off and the revenue collapse. So it's to brace for Chinese economic coercion. The second point is that the day that the Chinese do try to exert economic coercion on Australia will be the day that they lose any remaining friends and they persuade Australia that all of the scaremongering about China is actually true.
So when we are looking at our position, our outward-facing position as a country, and we have this long-term strategic ally in the United States and this very important trading partner in China, which of those two relationships is more important to Australia?
Well, they're both essential. It's like saying which hand is more important.
Exactly.
And it's also not a unique dilemma. More than 120 countries in the world now count China as their biggest export market. The US itself, China is its biggest export market. The US itself has this very same dilemma about how to treat such an enormous economic partner. So for us, we need both, and the answer is to throw our lot in entirely with neither. The answer is to deal as an independent nation state, exercising all our faculties, which we've essentially had on the snooze button for most of the last 70 years. As Alan Gingell likes to put it, our foreign policy for 70 years has essentially been, well, what have what the Americans are having, a bit more or a bit less. We just need to ditch that idea altogether, and it's taking a while, but I think we're gradually getting around to it, the Pacific policy being the latest example.
And to advocate for that rules-based order, which you could almost argue that some nations are being shocked into advocating for because of Trumpism.
James, when it comes to reporting on these issues, no outlet has probably reported more on China influence in Australia and in the Pacific than the Sydney Morning Herald. What are the factors that go into making the decision about how deep we go into those stories? It's not always uncontroversial, and sometimes it comes with defamation proceedings as well.
Yeah, and political criticism. There's the factors that contribute to us running these stories are that they are good stories. It begins and ends there. It's one of the defining yarns of, it sounds like a cliche, but of our generation. It's absolutely critical. And so I'm incredibly proud of our coverage on this, and I'm glad that the Herald and the Age, which I also represent, has led the way on this. We have been criticised at times, but I think most of the criticism has come from people who have blurred the lines between criticism of the CCP, the party, and Chinese people in general. And we are very careful to make sure that when we talk about Chinese influence, we're talking about the party or agents of the party and not Chinese people in general, because you can't generalise about Chinese people in Australia, for that matter, or Chinese people in China. That's too difficult and be wrong.
So the last thing I want to talk about is quite a change of pace. It's two stories that on the surface could be unrelated but have a lot of things in common. In March, former Russian military officer Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia were poisoned in the UK city of Salisbury with a nerve agent known as Novichok. Both of them narrowly survived. And then in October, Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi entered the Saudi embassy in Istanbul and never came out. Now, these two stories have a lot in common. They're both widely believed to have been state-sanctioned attacks on critics of powerful people in Russia and Saudi Arabia, conducted with extensive planning on foreign soil. They were both almost cinematic in the horror of the details of what happened, down to the point where both of them involved medical professionals on the hit squads. Do these two incidents show an escalation in what leaders are prepared to do to their critics, or has this kind of thing been going on forever and now we just know more about it because of CCTV and the fact that, you know, people's iPhone videos go into the cloud?
Look, I think there is a relationship. I note that when Obama was, very shortly after he was elected, he was given a Nobel Peace Prize, and a lot of his critics noted immediately he must be the first Nobel Peace Prize winner to have a kill list in his pocket, which he actually signalled in his speech. And yet the state-sanctioned killings of his administration were people who were believed to be terrorists. This sort of theatrical, demonstrative killing, I'm sure it's happened in the past, but the fact that it is happening so demonstrably at the moment, I mean, especially in the Russian killings, it was quite clear that the denials were not meant to be effective. The lack of denial was the signal. We're prepared to kill you wherever you are. And the fact that we've seen such another brutal killing now, I do think it signals for some regimes we are in a period, I'm not saying it's the first time, but a period of loosened restraint.
There's a really worrying trend in Europe at the moment where you have the right-wing populists, so Marine Le Pen, Matteo Salvini in Italy, as they turn away from Brussels, they're actually turning towards Moscow. So they will be very critical in a speech about the EU and what it's doing, and then at the same time they're making positive remarks about the Kremlin, and Putin doesn't need any encouragement on this front. So I think that unfortunate conversation that's going on in the right-wing fringes of Europe, and fringes probably isn't the right word, it's in countries like in Poland and Austria and Italy to a certain extent, it's more than a fringe, but it's allowing those countries like Russia to feel that they can perhaps be a little bit more robust and aggressive than they would have been in the past, which is deeply worrying.
Well, the suppression of your critics is the strongest urge for any powerful person. Yeah, in our system we have checks which prevent us being assassinated. But in many countries of the world, that's exactly what would happen to us. Mm. These sort of assassinations have occurred and do occur routinely around the world all the time. In fact, Richard Nixon, I heard a reminder on Radio National just this morning, had a plot to assassinate an American journalist, Jack Anderson, whom he found particularly odious. Fortunately...
Didn't he want to blow up the Brookings Institution as well?
Did he? I didn't know about that one. He's going to be a busy guy. But they were going to poison. They were going to poison this American journalist, Jack Anderson. So it's not a unique thing, and it's not a new thing. The reason I think that the Khashoggi and Skripal cases became so notorious and so widely viewed is because they were occurring by one state against another, where the victim state, if you like, decided to use that publicly as a pressure point against the offending state. If not for that, these would have remained secret, and they would have just been another unexplained heart attack or whatever disappearance. It's the fact that the Turks have waged this masterful piece of news management. They've got this story going, 7 weeks now? Every day there's a fresh lead on the Khashoggi case. Erdogan decided to use the Khashoggi case as a particular pressure point against the Saudis to force the US to take a tougher line on the Saudis. Very clear, very deliberate, and very impressive. Likewise, the Brits decided to go hard against the Russians on the Skripal case. It's state to state, with these unfortunate individual assassinations being used as the pressure point.
State elections rarely reflect the national mood towards our federal politicians. But in Victoria, things were a little different this year. In fact, the election threw up some points for the media to contemplate as well, regarding just what were the issues at stake for everyday people. Discussing the ramifications of this election on the panel is our federal editor and Canberra bureau chief Bevan Shields, news editor at The Age Michelle Griffin, and editor of The Age Alex Lavelle.
So I will admit that when I discovered I was hosting a panel about Victorian politics and federal politics, that the Victorian politics might just be a bit of a sideshow until the weekend, when I realised that this was actually an incredibly big story. Were you guys expecting the result on Saturday night?
Yeah.
Well, we were definitely expecting that result. I don't think anyone was expecting such a dramatic swing, particularly in some of the so traditionally liberal seats. I think that in politics generally, I think you find that people vote either for or against the government rather than for the opposition. And so I think the general feeling was that there wasn't enough momentum around reasons for getting rid of a first-term Labor government and Daniel Andrews, that they'd done enough. But I don't think anyone predicted the scale of it, no.
I'm going to put you all on the spot straight away, because that's fun. And by reading a little bit from a piece that state political editor Noel Tao wrote, probably on Saturday night, because I saw it published on the Age website pretty early on Sunday. Noel was supposed to be here tonight, but he couldn't be. He said, Andrews reckons he talks to, quote, lots of real people, as in civilians, who are not very involved in this contest, who become a wonderful barometer of things that are very big on Spring Street but mean very little on Main Street. That's Andrews' way of saying that the preoccupations of Victoria's political classes and media have got it wrong. Now there he is, leaving pundits scratching their heads as to how such a scandal-plagued government could have slaughtered its opponents like this. Do we in the media, and specifically The Age, do we focus on the right things when it comes to our political coverage?
I'd like to think that we spend a lot of time pushing. This is a conversation that I have with Noel all the time about, as Noel says, we've got to report the forest, not the trees. It's very easy to see, a scandal headline, particularly, in the cutthroat business that we're in, and say, why didn't we get that? Why aren't we on that? And you've got to keep pivoting back to, why is that headline there? What does it mean broadly? So we don't always get it right, but I think we are in the business of questioning ourselves as well. But there's two kinds of things you've got to ask. Both is, do they care? Like, does this really resonate with them?
Voters and readers?
Well, readers, yeah. Readers. I don't work for voters.
Yeah.
But also, why does it matter? And if you can come up with a reason there, sometimes you have to work harder to prosecute why a scandal matters, even if it does seem a bit obtuse per se. You've got to drag it back to the context rather than report every little inside baseball moment of it, I think.
Bevan, you're in a very different editorial position than people who work at The Age in Melbourne, surrounded by the people that they're writing for. You work in the Canberra Press Gallery, which is a very unusual environment in that you're in Parliament House, you're in a corridor full of your competitors, your mates with some of your competitors, you know where you're hundreds of kilometres from your readers. Mm. How do you not get caught up in what Scott Morrison refers to as the Canberra bubble?
That's the great challenge, and that's something that we are trying to work out at the moment when we're planning how we'll cover next year's federal election, because I think a valid criticism for everyone in the 2016 election, that's the media, both sides of politics, was that everybody missed the really strong concern in the electorate about health and Medicare. And that really didn't materialise until the election night when we saw that. Now, I think, you know, the PM likes to call it a bubble, and that's a bit of a cheap shot, but there's some truth to it. That said, the politicians encourage it in a way. So, for instance, we are looking at election coverage next year. Each side of politics has a bus. They'll have a bus and they'll have a plane. They'll go around the country and they want the media, they want The Age, they want everyone to go on their bus and follow them. The problem with that is all you do all day is get on and off a bus and listen to what somebody, a politician has to say.
You don't get anywhere near,
you don't
any voters,
get anywhere
do you?
Near the voters. So, you know, my personal view is I think we should get off the buses a lot more next year and actually talk to the people that they're visiting. I mean, that's our job. And I think in a way, you know, on the Victorian election, we're slightly guilty that I underestimated the federal impacts on what would happen down here. We've all sort of moved on from the Malcolm factor relatively quickly because there's so much going on in Canberra that you're just going with that. I think we all missed the anger that was still down here about what happened to Malcolm.
Yeah. Alex, how do you, when you're in your, you know, palatial cubicle at The Age, how do you keep in touch with what readers are genuinely concerned about as opposed to what, you know, might get a good click?
I mean, there's a few things, Tori. I think we're in a fortunate position now in terms of journalism in that we can measure everything. So when we publish a story, there are several ways to measure the reaction to that story, whether it's comments on it, I get emails from readers, how interested people are in that story. And rather than, I think, you know, in decades gone by where journalists were really, you know, serving up what they thought readers wanted and it was almost a, like, take it or leave it scenario, we are very, I think, in tune with what our readers want and what they're reading and what they're finding interesting. And one of the things I've always thought, because I'm obsessed by readers' comments, I read them all the time. And so when there's a big story that we publish and the Herald Sun publishes and the Australian publish, for example, I see on the comments on the Herald Sun stories and the Australian are very much down a particular path and they're 90% of them will take a particular angle. The comments on The Age come at it from all sorts of different angles, and that's something that I love engaging with. I also, for all reporters, all the time, Michelle and I, and I'm sure Bevan and you yourself, Tori, are the same, talking to our friends, talking to people about what they're interested in. I always find when I say, you know, I'll work for The Age or I'm editor of The Age, that people always have an opinion about that. It's not always a good opinion, but they always have an opinion. They're always interested in what we're doing. They've always got ideas and thoughts. And so I like to think that we are in tune with our readers, but obviously we don't always get it right.
What do you think, readers? Do you think The Age is in tune with your interests? A smattering of applause.
we'll take it.
You've got to take it where you can get it.
Ringing endorsement.
If you're thinking no... write a comment, write an email. We use Tipstars, so you can even vent anonymously, fill in the surveys. We are open 24 hours a day to your feedback, and we read it all.
Yeah. Let's get down to the nitty-gritty. There's just one more thing about the Victorian election I really want to talk to you about. Michelle, talk to us about preference whispering.
Ah, Mr.
How
Drury.
How did we end up with two members from the Transport First Party,
the taxi
someone from
lobby?
The Aussie battlers?
Maybe we get a battler. Not sure about the battler yet. Oh, no, there's
one. Shooters and Fisher.
That we will get a shoot and fishing, maybe two, possibly
so
three.
So how do you buy a seat in Parliament? How does that work?
There'll be some alleged here because I'm not, I can't state it, but it's very clear that Mr. Glenn Drury is a consultant and you pay him for his advice. We have been told by some aggrieved former clients that it's $5,000 up front. And in this election, up to $50,000 if you were to get one of you into an upper house
seat. It's a bargain.
Well, when you think about it, 4 years on a base salary of $140,000 a year, plus all your allowances and your loadings, you know, you
not
could
a bad investment.
Dig into your mortgage, buy yourself a job as an MP. But I want to put this is. The only person we're certain of has definitely paid a certain amount is Fiona Patten, who admitted that in the 2014 election, when she was in the then Sex Party, the Eros Foundation, which helped set up the Sex Party, paid him $20,000 for her lucky slot. Mm-hmm. But she reported him for his payment interest to the Victorian Electoral Commission, who have referred it to the police. The way it works is that you have to choose a winner. And you have to, and it only works if you've got people across all the upper house areas. So the battlers help trade off things to get a taxi guy here, the Transport Act Matters person here, and you maybe get the animal justice people in, because quite a lot of people think animals are nice, and so they actually, of their own bat, you can recruit them in. Maybe they don't have a lot of money, you don't ask them for a lot of money, have a sliding scale. But everybody trades preferences across the whole lot of the different slots to work out who gets a piece across the whole spread. It's like playing poker in sort of five different divisions at once. Whereas take the Northern Metro division, where Fiona Patten is very popular, and she was up against a very popular socialist local councillor. Stephen Jolly got 6% of the vote, she got 4% of the vote. Both of them are out of it, and one of the Darren Hinch's Justice Party colleagues is up on less of the vote because they fought against each other and didn't direct preferences to each other, and they're out.
Okay,
terrible system.
It is a terrible system, it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out federally. Mm. I want to move on to the impact of the Victorian election on the federal coalition, Bevan. Scott Morrison is having a very tough time at the moment, isn't he? How much of what happened on the weekend plays into that?
A lot. We saw it today. It was an earthquake, really.
So what happened today?
So Julia Banks, who's the Liberal member for Chisholm here in Melbourne, fun fact, she was actually the only Liberal to win a seat in the 2016 election. They lost the rest of them. She has resigned from the government, so she's gone to the crossbench. So they already lost Malcolm Turnbull's seat of Wentworth, which plunged them into minority government. Now they're another one down. Now that doesn't mean that the government will fall, but they're in an unbelievably precarious position, and lots of things could get through the House of Reps now if all the independents are on side. So the one that most people are looking at the moment is a possible referral to the High Court of Peter Dutton to test whether he's eligible to sit in Parliament.
Oh, so that gets a bigger clap than the Age. Age's political coverage.
So
that's a tough crowd.
That's a big deal. Now, it's also said, just on the Julia Banks thing, the other thing I just mentioned is while everyone's been sitting in here, the new sitting calendar came out for next year. There are only two sitting weeks before effectively the election.
Right.
So, I mean, that goes to show how concerned they are about their position in the House of Reps.
So they've also brought the budget forward, haven't they? So they can deliver a budget in April?
April 2 or 3, and then off we go to the election in May. Obviously, beyond Julia Banks, it's triggered another round of fighting about what is the Liberal Party's identity, what is the Liberal Party anymore? And what's been really interesting this week is, for the first time, we've seen the moderates in the Liberal Party really starting to assert their authority a bit and starting to shut down some of the conservatives. Now, that's not going to do the job. They need to do a lot better job of that. I think the only thing that will save Morrison at this point is Christmas, and everyone can just go back to where they live and have a breather and actually listen to their electorates. Voters are angry. Voters are angry, and they're going to go back to their electorates in Christmas, and they're going to get that. So I think everyone will go quiet over Christmas, but they're deeply, deeply divided, and he's in a world of trouble. And I mean, I probably spoke to 15 Libs on Sunday and maybe 10 or 12 on Monday, and just not one of them thinks that they're going to win in May. Not one of them.
So, Bevan, do you think the federal government might spend some money in Victoria now, having not done so for quite a long time, and, you know...
That worked. Daniel Andrews proved that works. People like infrastructure. I mean, it's a no-brainer, isn't it? It's a no-brainer. People like roads and rail and bridges and whatever.
Schools, hospitals.
And luckily for them, the money is just pouring into the budget. The economy is rolling over really nicely. Money is pouring in. Their strategy for the election is going to be, we'll have a budget in early April. We'll have the budget. That's going to shower money at people. We'll have an election pretty well straight away, and the election will be, have this money, and there'll also be a bit of a scare campaign here and there on things like negative gearing, national security, possibly Labor's retiree dividend franking credits policy, which is starting to bite a little bit.
Do you think scare?
There's a two-step sort of strategy there about, you know, throwing money but also scaring people.
Yep.
Do you think scare campaigns work, Bevan? I mean, I think the Mediscare probably did.
Yep. Yes, if scare campaigns work if there's a little bit of truth to them. And I think that's why Medicare worked, because the government did not have a good record on health funding. They didn't. So that was in the back of people's minds. Now, I don't think the crime scare campaign worked in Victoria because people were just not convinced from the start that there was an enormous issue here. So if it's executed properly and if it's actually based on something, some sort of substance of truth, I'm not justifying them, I'm just saying this is how they'll work, then it can work, yeah.
My favourite sledge over the post-election, I think it was Scott Morrison, who talking about Bill Shorten saying he's no Daniel Andrews.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Although the best sledge of the election was Daniel Andrews, who usually, I mean, he's pretty reserved and pretty boring, let's be honest.
That's his special power.
That's right. But on Sunday, you know, he
everyone
does
loves
not,
a winner.
Very clearly does not like Michael Kroger, because he had a big, strong crack at Michael Kroger, bopping about in suburbs in Melbourne wearing a Burberry trench coat and talking about the cost of living, which was... That was pretty savage.
It was quite the burn.
Yep.
Alex, do you think that the women issue is going to be a big factor for the Libs? I believe that there are now more Davids in the Victorian Liberal Party room than there are women.
The same number.
Same number, okay.
No, I think it's undoubtedly an issue, Tory. Yeah. And I think, I was going to say, if you haven't read Julia Banks' speech today, it's well worth a read. And I think the whole Liberal leadership should have a look at it and basically do as she suggests.
The Liberal Party, feasibly, when you look at who's retiring and whose seats are under threat, the Liberal Party could come out of the next election with five women in the House
in
of Representatives.
Federal House of Representatives.
I mean, just imagine imagine when you look at that chamber, what that is going to look like. It's going to be a sea of suits and five women. That would be the worst in 25 years.
And yet they maintain that they can't have quotas because it's all got to be on merit.
Yeah, yeah.
And can I say, on merit... the two significant swings towards the coalition in Victoria were women working for the National Party, who are smart and savvy and loved up their electorates like crazy. And they got big swings to them. Mm. They were the only ones.
Steph Ryan was one of them, and she's terrific. Yeah. Yep.
Yep. So my final question to the whole panel is, should our federal parliament have four-year fixed terms for elections?
Yes. In short, it's a no-brainer because everyone else is doing them. 90% of countries in the world have 4 years or more. Of all the parliaments in the world that are bicameral parliaments, so that's two houses like us, only three have three-year terms. The Philippines, Mexico and us. So It's a no-brainer, and
good,
you know,
knowledge, Bevan.
The big complaint from everyone is governments aren't doing anything anymore, and that's because everything has sped up so fast. In a three-year cycle, it takes 3 to 6 months for a new government to get really grinding. They have maybe a year, 18 months if you're
lucky.
Then
they have to kill a prime minister.
And then you're into an election.
Then
that extra year would work wonders for reform. And it would also, business confidence in Australia would skyrocket because they would have more certainty to invest because they wouldn't be expecting governments to be tipped out every couple of years. Now, this went to a referendum in 1988 and it failed abysmally. So, right. I mean, I think the only way they can do it to get it through a referendum is to
bipartisan,
but also as a bigger package about cleaning up politics. So everyone's annoyed. Everyone doesn't like this short-term cycle that we've got going. They could fix that. They could do something around election donations still. They could potentially move to a full public funding model, which would cost a lot of money, but it would get rid of the influence of of money in politics. They could do a federal ICAC. And they could do some lobbying reform. And if it was packaged like that and both sides were on board, I think it would sail through.
Just finally, Alex, what do you think the priorities are for The Age in 2019 on federal politics and our coverage?
That's a question without no history.
Sorry, Alex. this is so fun.
I think one of the things that actually did touch a bit of a nerve in the Victorian election, which is underestimated how important people think these two issues are, one being domestic violence and the other being mental health. And those two things, I think, are clearly... there are big problems here, big problems throughout the world, but I think those are two areas that need a lot of investment, a lot of thought, a lot of constructive ways to help in both those two areas. So those will be... certainly two areas that I think we should concentrate on.
And fixed four-year terms?
Fixed four-year terms are good. How quickly can that change, Bevan?
Well, it'll have to go to a referendum, so...
be a year away,
which would have
best.
To presumably happen at the election, that they would have the referendum at the same time.
I can't see them getting their heads
so around. So we've got a bit of time to campaign on that.
Yep.
Yeah.
Not all that long ago, I wanted to start a campaign about having every... ATM machine free, like the stupid $2.50 charge. And just as I was about to start that campaign, Commonwealth Bank
announced.
They did it. And it was like rats.
Stole
so
your
this
thunder.
One, we've got a bit of time on this one. Good. Yeah.
All right. We're out of time. Thanks very much. Summer's a great time to catch up on podcasts. Driving down to the beach or time off overseas. If you know someone who would love Please Explain, help them find the pod. We're also keen to know what you'd like to hear more of in the new year. You can email the team via the podcast link on the Sydney Morning Herald and Age websites. Please Explain is brought to you by the newsrooms of The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. Subscribing to our news service gets you unlimited access to award-winning, independent journalism and great behind-the-scenes content you can't get anywhere else. Follow the link in our show bio to get a subscription today. This episode was produced and edited by Declan Bowring. Technical assistance from David McMillan, Cormac Lally and Tom McKendrick is our head of audio. I'm Tori Maguire. Thanks for listening.